Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for June 7th, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening, sir.
And welcome back to the country and to the Kudzu Vine, Catherine Smith.
Hello, everyone. I'm glad to be back. It's good to be back.
Yeah, now you went overseas to Italy, correct? Tell us just quickly about your trip.
Well, I spent a week on the island of Sicily, which is, in Italy, but their own island. It's wonderful, beautiful terrain, wonderful food, lots of fresh fish, and a lot of support for Hillary Clinton, we found. They're very interested in American politics in Europe. I've always found that to be true. But the last time I was in Italy was in 2007, and they didn't like Hillary. They liked Obama. I remember a guy in a market saying, "No Hillary, no Hillary." But this time, on a couple of occasions, it came up, and they were all very supportive of Hillary. So,
yeah, sounds like those
anecdotal
odd people stay together. The Italians and the Iowans, because that's how Hillary Clinton's hoping it'll go this time. Because of course the Iowans kind of were the same way, and that's what changed things. Well, so you got back on you went through a lot of airports, both in Italy, other places, and layovers in Atlanta. Did you see any people toting assault rifles like we did in Atlanta?
I did not see any ordinary citizens with guns in any airports. You do see guns in European airports being carried by security. It's not uncommon. I don't remember if I saw them in the airport, but it doesn't ever surprise me to see it there. But I was in the Atlanta airport when that happened, but I was in the international terminal, or it was the same day when I came through. But I missed the excitement around the guy walking through with his assault rifle.
Yes. Tim, this was Jim Cooley, who was dropping his daughter off for her flight to Chicago, and he had a AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle slung over his shoulder, and he had it loaded with 100 rounds of ammunition. I mean, this guy looked like he was, going to war. Also, it kind of like he was going to, a Star Trek biker bar convention with the gun all in one, actually looking at him. But he's carrying this gun around, and I guess people are thinking, you get arrested when you go backward on the escalator in the Atlanta airport. There's no way you can legally bring an assault rifle through the airport, correct?
Wrong. There are certain sections of that airport you can bring your weapon in according to the laws of Georgia. Now, there are certain sections that you cannot carry a weapon into in the Atlanta airport that are under the province of the federal government. I think at some point the federal government and the state government are going to lock horns. Something's going to happen. And they're going to lock horns. This guy's reasoning was that basically he said that if he doesn't exercise his right to do what he did, then that right would be taken away by the government. Are y'all following that logic? I didn't.
Even hardcore, gun supporters wouldn't have done this. But he thought, well, I'll just get myself some attention. He's actually been arrested carrying a gun on school property or too close to school property in Gwinnett County probably about 2 years ago, it looked like. So this is not his first time he's made news with his guns, if you will. But now, an interesting discussion got took place that said, what if somebody of maybe not Islamic descent, if you will, or actually Arab descent, because Islam's a religion and Arab is a nationality, if you will, or culture, or what have you. But what if somebody that looked like the stereotypical terrorist, if you will, and once again, heavy on the word stereotype, that could be somebody from, even India, but
yeah,
what if they carried a gun? What if they carried a gun into the airport? What would happen? There's a lot of discussion of that.
Put a turban on the guy's head and watch the fur fly. That's all you'd need to do, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, then it would be that person's right to do the same thing. But, Catherine, would they get equal treatment?
Oh, of course not. I mean, first of all, I think the public would be troubled by it. You know, I mean, I would have been troubled if I'd seen this guy walking down through the airport. But, no, I don't think you put a turban on that guy, and yeah, the whole picture changes.
Yeah, look, a civil liberties thing, go to a trial.
David, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Sorry, and my thumb is not over the speaker, if you will. Am I any better now?
You are
it's
now.
Just dropping off a little, but it's a little better.
Okay. For a little bit longer, and then I'll do my little excursion outside to hopefully get better reception. But in about 13, 14 minutes, we'll have to find out what goes on in the Jackson Airport, because Robert Hooks will be calling in from Mississippi, and we'll have to compare notes on that. But I just wanted to drop that in, that Robert will be our guest. Usually I'm a little better about getting that in early in the show, but we're so excited to have Catherine back, we had to segue into all these segments. Well, while we're staying on transport, let's just keep it clean and continue on about transportation. And this week, probably around Friday, Saturday, an article came out about the Rubio's driving record. And I'd have to find the article. I know I sent it to y'all. It said, combined, they have 17 moving violations. 14 are Marco's, 13 are his wife's.
No. Four.
Four
for Marco and 13 for her. 17.
That's what
total.
I said. Four. Yeah, four for four. I had
no,
it.
No, you said 14.
Oh, 14. Okay. So 13 for her, four for Marco,
right.
17 total. I was thinking one off on, but I was closer than I thought I had mixed up. But anyway. There's this, this big issue, and then, of course, he said, well, that many moving violations just makes you an average driver in Florida. I think he was talking about himself, not his wife, because I'm not sure there's any state in which 13 tickets is normal. I certainly don't want to spend much time driving in a state where that would be normal. Not that we want to offend Floridians and actually say that it is. But a lot of driving problems here. They've actually had to go to driving school, if you will. I know for sure she has. I'm not sure if four gets you there for him, but it sounded like both had. Was that the idea you got, Tim?
Well,
both
yeah.
Had gone?
You know what's really funny is the New York Times, of course, published this article. Well, that's got the conservatives raging. Fox News, I believe it's Greta Van Susteren, got on there. What kind of journalism is this? Blah, 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 blah. But do you guys remember when Obama was running, it came out that he had some outstanding parking tickets from when he was in college. And so he went back and paid them. And they just railed about that. Now, what's different now?
Well, moving violations are a lot different than parking tickets.
Well,
moving violations are indicative of disrespect for the law, I think.
Catherine, you're segueing into my next question. You know, obviously, a news source can write this article because they have to sell papers, get viewers, whatever it may be, and it's an interesting story, and he is a public figure. And therefore, writing it is fair game. Whether he's, you know, a Democrat or a Republican, liberal, conservative, what have you. Now, the next question is asked is this a campaign issue? Catherine, it sounds like you're saying that this could be a presidential question, if you will. Tell us why.
Well, I don't. I admit I didn't see the article. I don't know if I just missed that email, but I mean, I think if four moving violations, I don't know in what time period, but I've been driving for, oh, I don't want to say how long, along many, many decades, and I don't think I've had two moving violations. I think I've had two speeding tickets in my life in 40 years of driving. And I'm not, I mean, I'm not a particularly, you know, over-cautious driver, but I respect the law. I respect the speed limits. I'm conscientious. I recognize that driving has a huge responsibility and can be very dangerous, and a car is a lethal weapon. And I think someone who's running for the highest office in the land, I think we expect them to be responsible and respectful of all the laws, driving laws, you know, tax laws, all those kind of laws. So, I mean, I'm not going to say it would necessarily, I mean, I'm not going to vote for him anyway, but I'm not going to say that it would definitely preclude me from voting for someone, but I think it's a interesting bit of information. It just, you know, is further information about that you use to draw a conclusion about whether you're going to support a candidate or not.
Yeah, it has something to do with a responsibility, and I know what you're saying. You know, that's a lot of tickets in a short time. Funny story, just this past week, I think not either in the number of years I've been driving since the late 80s, and I had a speeding ticket back, I want to say in 2007 or 2008, been a little while. This past week, I got this check in the mail for like $10 from the I want to say Smith County, Virginia, you know, clerk of courts. I'm like, what's this about? And then there's a letter saying, oh, we found out that we overcharged people on speeding tickets, and there was a class action suit, blah, 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 and here's the money you were entitled to that we overcharged you. So I thought that was kind of interesting that that story came up, and the way you were talking about your driving record, that this past week, the only time or the last time I had something like that happen, I actually was overcharged and got money back for it. So there is something that fits in there. Tim, how much of an issue do you think this is?
I don't think it's much of one, but I want to get back to the point I made earlier. Why is it the people who are saying how unfair this is, that this story is being reported, are the same people who piled on President Obama and said that was fair game when the story of his parking tickets came out? Isn't it a little hypocritical for them to say this story is not fair, but the Obama story was fair? I don't get that. That would be my only issue with this whole thing at all.
Well, that's kind of a common theme. You know, when a Republican does something, there's some on the right that want to beat up on whatever news source, and they want to see it as different. And I'm sure we could point to cases on the left where it happens with some people too. But, you know, like we're going to talk about Louisiana politics. What David Vitter did in his own private life was just, you know, pretty over the top. And obviously Democrats have done the same or less, I would probably say less, and have been drummed out of office or censured in some way by the right. Yeah. And David Vitter, I mean, he can't be praised enough by the conservatives. So, I mean, to me, that's a perfect example of double standard, if you will. And
yep.
So, you know, this may be a double standard, probably less of one that's important, if you will, because it's, you know, it's traffic tickets compared to, you know, prostitution and get involved like David Vitter. I wonder, you know, a lot of times, you know, some spouses are very hesitant to get into the spotlight in which, you know, obviously running for president gets you. I wonder if Mrs. Rubio knew that when he, Marco Rubio, ran for president, that her, you know, really bad driving would get a light shined on it. Catherine, do you think she signed up for that?
I really feel strongly about this. Moving violations are very dangerous. Driving is a huge responsibility. Many people die in car accidents every year, more than in many other ways in this country. And I think it's really important to recognize that it is a big responsibility. I think it's more important than some of these other, you know, sort of victimless crimes that we talk about sometimes. It's a huge responsibility. And I don't know what the moving violations were. I don't know if it was speeding or if it was driving under the influence, then I have no patience for that. No patience whatsoever. No tolerance. So, I mean, I don't think we emphasize enough how what a huge responsibility is to drive. We take it very lightly. You see it all the time: people driving while talking on the phone, while eating their breakfast, you know, reading the newspaper, whatever. But it is a big responsibility.
Yeah, I think it was no DUIs involved. It was just not being a good driver. I mean, it sounds
right.
Like, you know, if they live in a major city, maybe she needs to get more on the rapid transit. I don't know their financial standing, if they can afford a driver, if you will, probably not. Maybe that's why he's running for president, so they'll have the limousine.
So he can have a driver.
They won't have to drive anymore. I'm running for president to save my wife's life. She'll have a driver, you know. Tim, do you think she likes this attention she's getting?
Well, you know, I hate to break this to her, but she's going to get attention, as all the families do, of people running for president. Now, that's probably not overly fair. I really think, whenever possible, families should just be left off the table. But if these people complaining now are, for instance, saying, well, there's a liberal bias in the media, I tell you what, you'd have a tough time convincing Bill and Hillary Clinton that there's a liberal bias when it comes to reporting about families, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You know, it's not happening.
And once again, that was a newsworthy story and had to get covered.
If a woman got 13 tickets for crying out loud.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mentioned Louisiana and said we'd get there, and I think it was the poll, Tim, that I sent you last week. We didn't get a chance to talk about it, and so now's the time. And there's a lot of numbers in this Southern Media and Pew Research poll, but the one really, I think, people notice quickly is the approval rating of Bobby Jindal and, in turn, the approval rating of the president. Bobby Jindal has an approval rating of roughly 32%. We'll round up for him. The president has an approval rating of 42%. We'll round down against him, if you will. And, Catherine, my question is what does this say about Louisiana, the fact that Bobby Jindal is running for president, a two-term governor, it's a Republican state, and yet he is, you know, 10 points more unpopular than the president, who is supposedly not popular in the Bayou State?
It says that he's living in a dream world if he thinks he can actually run for president. I mean, if he's got a 31% approval rating in his own state, how does he expect to garner support around the country? The man's
amazing. I don't know. 31%, I mean, that is hugely unpopular. You think it would actually begin to erode the Republican base in the state, but I'm not sure it will. Tim, do you think this will have a drag on Republican candidates?
No, no, and I'll tell you why. There's a faction that supported Governor Jindal, and there's another faction that supports Senator and soon-to-be Governor, I guess, Vitter. They have had a feud going for a long time for control of that party. I think Senator Vitter is clearly winning. Jindal is a lame duck on his way out. His first foray onto the national stage, you might recall, to give the GOP response to the State of the Union was not well received, to put it mildly. And he's just, Catherine's right, he's not going to go anywhere on the national stage here. The president's approval rating in that state, by the way, is pretty much typical of the president's approval rating in the Deep South, in the low 40s, right along in there. So, you know, Jindal's, his career's about over, and he was going to be one of their golden boys just, what, 5 years ago, David?
Yep. Yeah, and there's more I'd like to say about it, but I got to leave Louisiana. The last time I physically left Louisiana, I left Louisiana and went through Mississippi. And that's metaphorically what we're going to do here on the show is we're going to welcome our guest, our good friend, our multi-time guest from Mississippi, Mr. Robert Hooks. Welcome, Robert.
Well, hello, hello, hello. Thank you for letting me come back on again.
Oh, yeah, always. My wife said, what you got on the show? I said, well, Catherine's back on vacation. I said, we're going to have Robert Hooks. That's like one of our very best, if not our best guest we always have. And so just love having you on the show. Because there was a really good special election, kind of intriguing special election for a House seat, and we just neglected to talk about it for whatever reason, even though Tim, you know, sent me emails about it and did his job. We just never got to it, but with you on the show, we're going to get to it. It was a two-parter, and the first part was kind of a free-for-all, top two candidates make the general or the big runoff or what have you. And surprisingly, I guess in some quarters, a Democrat made the runoff. What's that an indication of, Robert?
Well, you had, I believe, 10 people, 11 people running in that nonpartisan race. All of them except one self-identified as a Republican. The Democrat, Walter Zinn, was very much a Democrat and made a big deal about it. And, you know, when you have the vote divided up that much, it's not as surprising that the Democrat not only made the runoff, but actually led that night, came in first in a field of 10. But still well below the 50% mark. 2 weeks later, there was a runoff, and he doubled his vote almost. He went from about 15,000 votes to about 30,000 votes, which was far more than the Republican Kelly, who won, was able to do. As far as doubling the actual number of Republican votes, not his own personal vote. But that race has, I have to tell you, has been hurtful in a sense, because it goes to show how much we neglect races that seem difficult. Now, the DCCC has not been able to put together a plan to give them a majority in Congress in a long time. And no matter how they do their plans, you can bet, ignoring districts like Mississippi's first, among other deep southern states, is among them. But I'd like to point this one fact out. In this race, I did a spreadsheet on this race, and I emailed it out. But Walter Zinn, the Democratic nominee, received a little over 28,000 votes on Tuesday in that district. Barack Obama received 113,000. Trent Kelly, who won, received 67,000 votes. That's 45,000 votes less than Barack Obama did. And what I'm And when you look at where those votes were, what counties they were, much of that potential Democratic vote was only in a handful, only in about 6 or 7 counties. If you look at DeSoto County, Mississippi, which you know well, it is a suburb of Memphis. That county in 2012 voted 21,000 votes for Obama, but this Tuesday only voted 2,600 votes for the Democratic nominee. And what I guess what I really would like to get across to people is when you're in the Deep South, you have to run an orthodox style campaign. You have to kind of come at them in a different way. And I think a really good get out the vote effort could have brought this race much closer. And it's a missed opportunity. And I get a sense, I may be wrong, I get a sense we've had a lot of missed opportunities all over the country. It's one of the reasons why we're not in control of Congress.
Yeah, that sounds like some really good analysis. A follow-up question I have, and then I'm going to turn over to Catherine and Tim for questions. How did Walter Zinn do in comparison to Travis Childers in the special election, the time in which Travis Childers won? And I know the district may be slightly different, and that may change the calculus, if you will.
The district is pretty much the same. The I don't have that in front of me. I wish I had that spreadsheet up, and I wish I could call off the top of my head. Travis did far better in both his percentage and in his total vote count. He really beat numbers all across the board. But I was political director of that campaign and worked under Chris Smith from Nashville. And I can tell you what the field team was doing in that campaign was targeting, putting hundreds of thousands of dollars into a very small number of precincts, drilling very deep in very good wells is what we did. So we didn't try to take a small amount of money and spread it out over a massive geography. Logistically, that's a hard thing to do in a short period of time. But rather, we concentrated on where we saw the biggest number of presidential votes who didn't show up for any other election, and we touched people 6 and 7 times. The number of times we were going to people's houses during that election was incredible. And it was not the kind of operation you typically see in the South. So it would be something to be very familiar to someone who's worked in Florida or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin. Any of those states that are regularly targeted would have seen that kind of campaign. And, in fact, we brought people from those states down to do it. But I would also like to say that there was another big difference, to be fair. When Travis Childers was elected in North Mississippi, George Bush, his approval ratings were in the high 30s. So, and of course, we were in the middle of the presidential election that year. It was a few weeks before the actual presidential election. But you really had a very demoralized Republican Party. And it was the last election before social media was a big player. So, you know, I sort of put a dividing line between elections before 2008 and those after 2008, just because you did have, because social media, in my opinion, is so revolutionary, and it was not playing it. Did not have an impact in that election.
Yes. Well, I'm going to pass along to Catherine, then Tim, for questions about either this race or something else in Mississippi politics. Catherine?
Well, amen, brother Robert. You know, this is like the biggest problem we have in the Democratic Party, in my opinion. We see it all the time across the country. People don't vote in, certainly in special elections, but they don't vote in, you know, the midterm elections either. And it's so frustrating to me when I talk to people and they say, oh, I voted for the president. And I'm like, well, there's a lot of other things to vote for.
That's right.
And and I, you know, I rack my brain. I think the methods that you talked about where you target vote-rich districts and precincts and areas, I think that's probably the best short-term strategy for campaigns. But I think what I think really is required is for off-season, not campaigns, not the actual candidates, but whether it's parties or issue-based organizations or whoever's working to in voter registration and voter engagement, is we just have to show people make the connection for people between what's happening in their communities and how they vote has an impact. I mean, it was so frustrating to see these states where everyone was in favor of raising the minimum wage, but then mm-hmm. they voted for people who weren't willing to raise the minimum wage.
That's exactly right. And what you said about getting to these precincts in off years is a key. Very often in the Deep South, where we don't have that many targeted congressional races, we often go 4 years between visiting a precinct from one
yeah.
gubernatorial race to the next. There should never be a year in which a registered voter or even a house in a Democratic-rich precinct is not touched. First, we need to do it to keep our voter file up to date for when we do have the big races. And secondly, we need to do it because we need to register people who have moved in the last year so that they don't run into a problem at the poll. And three, we need to do it because we need to keep our volunteers trained. One of the real difficulties in doing the Get Out the Vote campaigns in the South is it's not just knocking on a door and handing somebody something. There's a real skill in doing door-to-door campaigns, and it's something that you can see that volunteer on that third or fourth day really getting. And those people there are some people, they just love doing the door-to-door campaigns, even though they might not have thought they would have at first. But it is something you have to practice. Well, you atrophy over 4 years. We need to be able to have a band of volunteers and, frankly, some paid people as well doing this every year because just trying to pick up the pieces after 4 years, it is not a workable model.
Well, and the voters say, well, you know, I haven't seen you. Why do I only see you 3 weeks before it's time to vote?
Yep, that's exactly right.
You know, but, you know, thank you for that analysis. It's really helpful to see that it's not just here, it's everywhere. And I don't think it's just in the South. I think we see it, you know, across the country, maybe in lesser extremes, but I think it's happening everywhere. And on that note, I will pass it along to Tim.
Well, good evening, Robert, and thank you for being on with us. It's good to hear your voice again.
Well, you too, sir. Thank you.
Look, we had one Democratic candidate in one congressional election in the whole United States. Why would the National Party sit on pretty much on the sidelines for this race?
Well, let me tell you, that is a very good question, and I think that there are a lot of answers, but I'd like to focus on two. First, the outside of the South, we get pigeonholed. They put us in a place where they say we cannot win, but they don't really take time to understand why. They look at the black voting age population. They see if it's below 45%, they'll say, well, you can't win that district in the South. They don't invest in polling. They don't invest in public research. They don't invest in messaging here. And they create a self-fulfilling prophecy in part, and I don't think they do this maliciously, Tim, but I do think this happens in part because a lot of them, frankly, make their money off the states in which they have investments in. So you have people who are making funding decisions for the party and for the party apparatus who make a lot of money off those funding decisions because they have operations in Ohio and in Wisconsin and in Maryland and so on and so forth. And I don't necessarily think that they do that purposely, but more or less it's for their self-interest law. But here's the second part, and this is going to be the part that is the bigger trend. I don't know how much influence the political parties have anymore. We have talked about the super PACs so much that I think that we've almost become numb to the fact that they really have kind of taken over. When I was talking to a congressional candidate in the Great Lakes region just this morning, and the entire conversation was about which super PACs were going to be getting involved, even though we couldn't coordinate with them. You know, that was a big part of the discussion. Those sorts of conversations would never have taken place in that way with that kind of precedent just 6 or 7 years ago. And now it's not really about will the DCCC get involved necessarily or will the Democratic Party get involved. It's what, you know, what multimillionaire can you hook your cart to? And there aren't a lot of multimillionaires in the South or a lot of multimillionaires anywhere who are anxious about hooking themselves to our card. If the law does not change, and I hope the law does change, but the law doesn't change, we are going to have to do a better job of cultivating people who can put direct money into campaigns as well. That's a long-term strategy. It's not a short-term thing. But I do think as a practical matter, that's something we have to do.
So what you're saying, essentially, the way this played out, the way it was handled, Zinn really never had a chance to win this race, did he?
Well, I won't say that. I can tell you this. Nobody ever thought he had a chance. Not very many people thought he had a chance. Nobody who you might say of substance was really pushing for it. I did not think he was going to win. But, of course, I'm not a person of substance. But I can tell you this, and this is the point I want to go back to. The person who won, Trent Kelly, the congressman-elect, received 67,000 votes in that district. Barack Obama received 113,000. So there were 50,000 more people in that district willing to vote for Barack Obama than there were willing to vote for Trent Kelly. And if he never had a chance to win, it was because none of us believed that there was going to be an investment in apparatus capable of pulling those votes out. It wasn't so much that I think the candidate was bad, it's just I think the system for electing him was not very good.
Well, is District 1 then, are you saying it is a lot more competitive than this race would show in a congressional election?
I think it's certainly more competitive than what it was on election day. There should not have been a double digit. You should not have had double digits between the Republican nominee and a competent Democratic nominee. Whether or not a Democrat was really going to take it, you know, that's hard to say. But it should have been much more competitive.
Yes. And with that, I will pass it back to David.
All right. Well, we've talked about the special election, but we know in 2015, y'all are a state that actually has a gubernatorial election. So let's get into your current governor first, Phil Bryant. I saw a poll recently, and his approval rating was looked to be pretty high, but then I saw another thing where he endorsed a candidate in a city in the South End. I want to say it was Biloxi, maybe a different city. And that Phil Bryant endorsed candidate lost. And so it's kind of a mixed message for like, hey, Phil Bryant, come endorse more candidates so they lose too. But yet he's got this popular approval rating. What's the story here, Robert?
It was the city of Biloxi, and I was actually involved in that race. And he came down and made a big deal about endorsing this one candidate, again, a nonpartisan race. And it was laughed at. This is the third, I believe, local special election race in which the governor has come down to make an endorsement, and that person loses. I don't think endorsements matter that much, and I don't think the fact that his endorsement didn't matter. I don't think it's necessarily that people disapproved of Phil Bryant down there as much as they just thought it was weird that he was down there in that race. But Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, Louisiana, it's been a long time since we've had candidates that we really believe in. Now, I'm not saying we haven't had candidates that we should have believed in. I'm just saying culturally, it's been a long time. And I think with Mississippi, there is a lot of cynicism and there's a lot of bitterness. And I think that when you have a state with this much cynicism and bitterness, I think Phil Bryant is appealing to you. No one, I don't care how much a person may say they like Phil Bryant, no one believes Governor Bryant is going to do anything impressive. Nobody believes the schools are going to be better because he's governor. No one believes the roads are going to be better. No one has any expectations on him. And I think that's a real indictment of how people in the South see government. We don't have expectations. And Phil Bryant meets that very low expectation. I think that y'all know this, there is an us versus them attitude in the South that has nothing to do with governing, but everything to do with sort of thumbing your nose at the Congress or thumbing your nose at the rest of the country. And I think Phil Bryant thumbs his nose at the rest of the country. But he's been a very bad governor. And he's been a very ineffectual governor. And I hope that between now and November, his approval ratings come down as people see that they actually can choose something other than cynicism. We can do better than what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, we hadn't actually got into the governor's race yet, and I want to see if Catherine or Tim would rather phrase those questions. Tim, you got a question on the actual governor's race?
Yeah, I got one. Robert, in 2011, the governor was elected with 62% of the votes. Any chance he will actually expand on that number this year?
Well, it's possible. It's possible, but my guess is no. But I can't say it couldn't happen. But I do believe that if Vicki Slater is the nominee, you're going to have a candidate who is going to be much better funded, as well as a candidate who will be able to appeal to far more female voters. So I would be surprised to see Governor Bryant expand his numbers and would not be shocked to see Vicki Slater get a win behind her back at some point in the campaign. Now, I don't know that that will happen. But I would think that he probably was at his high water mark in that last election.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me pass it over to Catherine.
What do you think the issues that will be that will the campaigns will focus on? I mean, is it going to be infrastructure? Is it going to be, you know, what are the things that people are concerned about?
The Democrats are doing a good job of trying to stay in front of the message, and thus far they've been able to make Governor Bryant respond. But the issue has been accepting of Medicaid money into the state. The idea of hospitals closing is a pretty terrifying idea, and it's something that not only can speak to any voter anywhere, but it's something that traditional Republican Chamber of Commerce voters get very upset about. The idea that their doctors, their hospitals, their clinics may close. The idea that we're not going to fund schools, but we will turn billions of dollars away that the federal government is trying to give to us, doesn't make sense to anyone. And it really appears that issue is going to be what the at least the early part of the campaign is going to be about.
Okay.
Keep in mind, we have a primary in August, and the Democrats have a Democrat primary for governor, and so you have three people in that race. It is generally assumed, though this may not be correct, that attorney Vicki Slater will be the Democratic nominee. But there are two other candidates running, one of them, Dr. Short, a female physician, and who is, you know, kind of unexpectedly started running a very tough campaign. So we don't know exactly who the Democratic nominee will be. So I'm having to guess a little bit about what the issues are.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
the three candidates, I guess Robert Gray would be the third, a retired firefighter, doesn't even seem to have an online presence. When they did a poll, they actually polled Vicki Slater and Valerie Short. Both of them really finished about the same against Phil Bryant. I took it that really neither one has a lot of name ID at this point in the state. Now you look at their web presence. Valerie Short has a nice-looking website with her picture of her in her military uniform. She does look more substantial as a candidate than I guess might have been expected. I don't get the names right since they both start with V. Vicki Slater, she expected to run unopposed or with very little or token opposition.
Yes, I think she did, and I think the fact that she's had to have a primary has probably not been a pleasant experience. But that's politics. She's tough. Vicki Slater is one of the toughest lawyers I've ever met, and she's one of the smartest people I've ever met. And when someone is that smart and that tough, and I don't know Dr. Short that well, so I don't know her as well, but she may be aptly described the same way. But what I do know is that there will be a female nominated by the Democratic Party for governor. I know that she will be very smart, and I know she'll be very tough. And they have, when that happens, the governor is going to have to answer some tough questions from a candidate who perhaps, because she's a woman, will have an audience who is listening more than what they're used to listening to. And I don't think what Governor Bryant has to say is going to be very appealing. He doesn't have anything to really appeal to swing voters. So as long as you can make the issue break down white voters versus black voters, then Governor Bryant will be fine. But when you have a tough candidate who can make this about black voters and white voters, about people who work for a living and about people who run multinational corporations through Mississippi because they pay little taxes and have no environmental regulations. When you talk about the fact that people of all races need to go to hospitals that Governor Bryant seems perfectly willing to shut down over a political point, when you talk about the fact that this is about jobs and not partisanship, I think Vicki Slater can make that message resonate because it's something she understands. And I think she's going to be a good nominee, if she is indeed the nominee. I think she'll be able to make those points quite well.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Fulbright. He's running, and he does have opposition, that may be token opposition in the Republican primary, and Mitch Young. Any chance that this Mitch Young gets more support than one would expect, and that causes Brian to
It's possible. There's still some wound licking over the Senate race here between Thad Cochran and Chris McDaniels. Governor Bryant has not seemed to suffer very much from it in any polling data that I have seen, or even just in conversations that I have had. There are other statewide Republicans who may be in greater danger. A more real problem for Governor Bryant or for any Republican isn't going to be their primary. It's going to be any third-party opposition. So say, for example, you have a Democratic candidate coming on stronger than expected as you get into October. If you have a third-party candidate appealing to Chris McDaniels voters, appealing to Tea Party voters, every vote they take, they're going to be taking it away from Phil Bryant or from the Republican nominee. And so if you have Democrats polling 5 or 6 points better than what you might expect to be polling, and then you have the Republican nominee polling 5 or 6 points less than what you would expect, you could you all of a sudden have a toss-up. And so that's probably something Democrats are hoping might happen.
Yes.
Well, before we go down ballot, got one more question to ask about the top race. Sean O'Hare. Now, he is according to Politics One, and they could be wrong. I don't think they're wrong that often on these lists, but they have Sean O'Hare running only for governor. Now, that's what we love about Sean O'Hare. He's not like a sniper that locks in on a target. He practices buckshot politics. He runs for them all. Now, I'm disappointed in Sean O'Hare. Next time you see him, you let him know I am. Why is he not running for all the offices like he does every year?
Well, it's funny you say that because I was thinking if I see Sean, I'm going to ask him if he's getting old. Because I remember a time when Sean would have run for every statewide office, the legislature, the county board of supervisors, and the clerk position. But I guess time starts to take its toll. I guess he's finally going to get serious about being governor.
Hey, you don't tell him he's getting old. You ask if he's getting smart. Because that's just a lack of effort right there, not running for every office on the ballot. Well, let's go ahead and go down ballot real quick. Tim, any races you want to ask about down ballot or Catherine? Tim first.
I don't have one down ballot, but I'd like to reserve a moment for one, shall we say, up the ballot. So I'll pass it to Catherine.
I don't have any either, but Robert, are there any that stand out for you that require a little attention or deserve a little attention?
Yes. The most interesting one will be the House of Representatives race. 4 years ago, the Republicans took control of the House for the first time. They accomplished redistricting, so this will be the first time we're running in the new districts. And 3 years ago when they did that, it was just assumed that this meant that Republicans would, expand their majority in the House. But what has happened, Democrats, under the leadership of State Representative Bobby Moat, who's the minority leader in the House, as well as Brandon Jones, the former member of the House, who now runs a PAC in Jackson called the Mississippi Democratic Trust, have recruited a really superstar list of candidates everywhere. And you have far more Democrats on the ballot than you do Republicans. You have far more Republican incumbents being challenged by Democrats than you have Democratic incumbents being challenged by Republicans. So there is it's iffy because we have the new district lines. The district lines were drawn to favor Republicans, of course. But when you look at some of these candidates, I mean, it kind of blows you away. So there's a effort among the Democratic leadership in the House, in coordination with the trial lawyers and the educators and everyone else who you would expect to have a stake in this, to really get behind legislative candidates. So I don't know what's going to happen to that, but I can tell you, keep your eye on the Mississippi House race, because if they can pull something off there, they may be writing a blueprint other states can follow.
That sounds great.
Well, Tim, go ahead with your question, not about damn ballot races.
Well, Robert, I've been scratching my head ever since I've seen this particular polling. There's been a lot of early polling in the presidential race for next year, not only at the presidential preference primary level, but testing this candidate against that candidate in general election matchups. When Hillary Clinton is tested against Jeb Bush, lo and behold, the state of Mississippi is a toss-up. Why on earth would that be?
Well, I have to confess, I was unaware of that, actually. But my gut reaction would be that because I think Jeb Bush does not resonate with voters here very well. I think he comes across as a third term for a president that lost favor in Mississippi as well as Georgia. As I said earlier, I well remember in 2008 when George Bush was polling at 38% to 39% in Mississippi. And so I would assume that that idea of him being a third term sort of is probably not something anybody in the state wants to walk into. But I also think that Hillary Clinton is a heck of a candidate. And I think there are a lot of people who don't like her who respect her. And I think there are a lot of people who don't like Jeb Bush, but who may not have, but who don't respect him either.
The poll, by the way, that I was alluding to was our friend Tom Jensen, public policy polling a number of months ago, found this race to be within the margin of error. At the same time, you would think a guy like Bush, whose approval rating would be highest in the South. And it just stunned me. If that's true, then he's really, really, really in a lot of trouble with her, isn't he?
Yeah, and in fact, I think all of the Republicans are in a lot of trouble with her. But you're right. If you're the Republican nominee, and Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana and South Carolina are in play, you're probably not.
Right.
but you're definitely. Right.
Yeah. Well, okay, David.
You brought up my on ballot. If a candidate, let's say Hillary Clinton, had a chance to try to get one of those three states, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, would Mississippi be her best shot at winning of those three, and why?
I would think Louisiana more than Mississippi, only because we have the votes in Mississippi. We have the demographic numbers to deliver Mississippi, but we do not have a campaign infrastructure. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You have to be able to mobilize a lot of votes beyond what you can do with earned media. You have to have campaigns on the ground in precincts. And I think because of Baton Rouge and because of New Orleans, you actually have those, you know, largely because of the Senate race that's taking place. The fact they've had a United States Senator until this recent, a Democratic United States Senator. They have that apparatus on the ground in high population areas. So if you made me snap my fingers and say which of those states would be the best, the most likely, I would say probably Louisiana. However, having said that, I would love to see the investment made in Mississippi, because I do believe that there are hundreds of thousands of potential voters in Mississippi who simply aren't going to turn out. They're not going to be a part of the process because they don't understand the process, they're a bit intimidated by the process, or they believe the process does not speak to them. And because they are silent, the process often does not speak to them. And I think that those very voters who were turned off are the very people who would be for our candidates. And they don't get heard. And so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I think Hurricane Katrina, and of course your state, Alabama, and certainly Louisiana, were all impacted by Hurricane Katrina with demographics and whatnot. But I think pre that, definitely Louisiana would have been the answer. But I, that really changed Louisiana's politics in a real advantage to Republicans. So I think it's a closer debate, much closer than it would have been. I definitely think Mississippi shows more potential than Alabama. And you can make a case for Mississippi showing more potential than Louisiana. And races like Travis Childers and the fact that Jim Hood's able to hold on and different things like that, there's some Democratic roots there that you can point to. Well,
Robert. Without question.
Yeah. Well, Robert, we just enjoyed so much having you again on the Kudzu Vine talking about Mississippi state politics.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Every time I come on here, I have a great time, and I always get so much positive feedback. Thank you, and thank you guys for what you all are doing.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, yeah. Sir.
Yes, and, sir. Catherine, good to have you back on the
Thanks.
Show after your two-week vacation. And next week we'll have another Kudzu Vine. And right now the guest looks like we're locked in to have Lachlan McIntosh of South Carolina. He's promised to talk about the upcoming South Carolina caucus with all the Republican candidates showing up and maybe some of the Democrats, because we know Martin O'Malley made some inroads down there. And so he'll talk about all that and in addition to the in-state politics of the Palmetto State. So until then, been the Kudzu Vine.
Good night, everybody.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
With a strong and united America still.